fond kiss and then we sever. If it will last forever, deep in heart-wrung tears, I'll pledge thee warring sighs and groans I'll wage thee.
Alex Heaton's rendition of the Robert Burns poem, A Fond Kiss, is in keeping with the sentimental side of Scotland's most beloved poet. But in 15 years or so of writing, without ever leaving Scotland, Burns covered a lot of other territory in wry satires and deft character sketches and in lyrics celebrating folly and drink. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did the son of an Ayrshire farmer become Scotland's most beloved poet in just a decade and a half? Who was he going after in those satires? Other than the dialect, what was so Scottish about his poems? And who were all those women in his poems? Joining us again this week is Carol Newlands, professor of classics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you.
It seems to me that even though Robert Burns was born almost 250 years ago, he's still very much with us. Every time we sing Auld Lang Syne, for example, can you talk about the enduring appeal of Robert Burns and how he may be with us even when we don't know that he's with us?
Right. I think a lot of people, when they sing Auld Lang Syne on New Year's Eve, don't realize that they're actually singing a Burns poem. Well, I think the quotation for me that best sums up his appeal is from the 20th century Scottish poet Edwin Muir, who says, "Burns is the poet for everybody because he was essentially an ordinary man who has real insight into ordinary thoughts and feelings, and he's accessible basically to everyone because he's able to combine Scottish dialect with ordinary English and taps into universal human sentiments and feelings."
It's been said that he's not a nature poet, he's a human nature poet.
I think he's a poet of nature and of human nature. After all, he's an 18th century poet, so he's very much influenced by the intellectual ideas of the day, coming from Rousseau about nature and the priority of nature over city life. He was born in the country. He was born on a farm in Ayrshire in the southwest of Scotland. He basically was a farmer all his life, not a successful farmer.
Well, it makes it even harder, doesn't it?
Probably spending your time writing poetry and womanizing doesn't go so well with balancing the books on the farm. But to blame also, it seems, was that he and his father inherited poor land on the farms. It was just a bad period for harvests when Burns and his father were farmers as well.
And politically, what was the situation? It's 1759 when he's born. What is the situation in Scotland and its relationship to England and also the revolutions about to happen?
Right. He's born 1759. He dies 1796, age 37. So it's a short life, but extremely eventful. So he lives through the American Revolution and the French Revolution. And the ideas coming out of these two major revolts in human thinking were tremendously influential on Burns. At this time, Scotland had finally joined up politically with England through what's called the Union of the Parliaments in 1707. So Scotland was part of what we now call the United Kingdom. So for 40 years or so. Not that everybody was happy with this political arrangement. Burns himself wrote a poem in which he said basically Scotland had sold out for the sake of English money and described the current politicians as a parcel of rogues.
Well, there was also, one of the big traumas in Scottish history, the Battle of Culloden in 1747, another one of those, trouncings, if I may, of the Scottish by the English. Was he living in the shadow of that too?
He was living in the shadow of that too. The Battle of Culloden was the final battle of what's called the Jacobite Rebellion, when Bonnie Prince Charlie, pretender to the Scottish throne, he had a rightful claim to the Scottish throne, came over and started a fairly successful rebellion. He got enough support to march south of the border and get as far as the Midlands of England, but then for some reason he turned back and lost this Battle of Culloden in 1746 and had to flee to France. He left Scotland, the northern part of Scotland, in disarray, and the whole Highland clan structure was broken up, led to tremendous immigration into Scottish cities, out of the country, and abroad to the USA and Canada. So Burns was a young man when the Jacobite Rebellion took place too, but it was unsuccessful, an attempt to turn back the clock and make Scotland a separate nation again.
He thought of emigrating to Jamaica at one point, didn't he?
He did. It's not clear why he thought of emigrating to Jamaica at that time, if it was political reasons or because he was in serious trouble with his love affairs. In that he seemed to have two women on the go, one his common-law wife, Jean Armour, but he seemed to have, meanwhile, got involved with a woman from the Highlands called Mary Campbell. So he was thinking of eloping with her.
Is it hard to separate out myth and fact in his biography? Because you seem to read different things about various love affairs or his drinking or different things, and they almost sound like the plots of some of his poems.
Right. It's very difficult to tell exactly how many affairs did Burns have. Was he really the ardent womanizer that is depicted in his poetry? Or can we really separate the muse from the life?
Right.
I think we'll never really know the truth.
DNA.
Can you say something also about the language? Because I think the unmistakable voice of Robert Burns comes through that dialect, through the unusual spellings, even in Auld Lang Syne, where it's the A-U-L-D for old. It's the Scottish dialect is so pronounced. Was that a sort of determined attempt on his part to break away from what would have been the influence of the English?
Absolutely. After the Union of the Parliaments in 1707, then the whole intellectual life of Scotland basically moved south, and Enlightenment thinkers like Hume and so on felt it was really important that they write in standard English so they would have as wide an audience as possible. And so the Scottish vernacular really was diminished by this impulse to make English the standard language for Scotland. Burns was a son of a small farmer, so he did get some formal education, but nonetheless he grew up speaking his vernacular dialect. He was familiar with standard English through reading the English poets, but he also would speak vernacular as he went about his business in town or on the farm. We do notice that when he wants to hammer home universal truths, he basically uses English rather than the vernacular. For instance, in his wonderful comic narrative poem Tam O'Shanter, he'll pause in the narrative and moralise, and he'll use English in this instance. So he will comment on, "Pleasures are like poppies spread. You seize the flower, the bloom is shed. Or like the snow falls in the river, a moment white, then gone forever." And then he'll go back into the Scottish vernacular for the actual narrative, which is much more gutsy and comic as well. So I think part of his success lies in his ability to make the Scottish tradition of vigorous social satire and commentary accessible to all.
Well, he has this great way of taking a very simple thing and extrapolating some universal theme from it. I'm thinking of this celebrated mouse.
Yes, and there's a background to that too. His first edition of his poems was published locally. It was essentially a sort of provincial attempt. It was published in 1786 in Kilmarnock. Just 612 copies were made. But he clearly had in mind trying to get a wider national audience because he did include a Scottish-English glossary in the back. So the English toffs in Edinburgh would understand. So yes, it made a big impact in Edinburgh. So he was invited to Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, And there was a second edition then published the following year with 3,000 copies. But he was under then tremendous pressure to write in English, as English was regarded as the language for elevated and serious thoughts. So if I could read one stanza from a poem that he wrote in English and compare it with the famous To a Mouse poem, I think you'll see how much more successful the vernacular To a Mouse is conveying ideas on the fragility of human existence and what an animal can teach us about that. But here, first of all, is the first stanza of Despondency, an ode written in English. Oppressed with grief, oppressed with care, a burden more than I can bear, I set me down and sigh. O life, thou art a galling load, along a rough, a weary road, to wretches such as I. Dim backward as I cast my view, what sickening scenes appear, what sorrows yet may pierce me through, too justly I may fear. Still caring, despairing must be my bitter doom, my woes here shall close never, but with the closing tomb. So I think you'll agree that's a downer of a poem and not terribly successful.
Fairly conventional.
And not that original voice that we would expect.
Not that original. But here's his poem on To a Mouse, which was written, he says, on turning up a mousey's nest with his plough the year before he went to Edinburgh and was lionized by the establishment. And this poem, of course, provided Steinbeck's title for Of Mice and Men,
yeah.
I believe.
Sure.
And sympathy for the mousey's fate, he didn't mean to destroy the poor mousey's house, leads then to general reflections on the fragility of human existence, hopes and dreams, and the difference between animals and humans, for we humans have to confront our past and our future. But it's the particular occasion that adds life, I think, to these general reflections. So the poem has an immediacy because he speaks in this voice as if he's just stopped from ploughing and sees that he's destroyed this little home that the mouse has built among the stubble of the field. Wee sleekit coor and timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start a while sae hasty, wee bickering brattle. The mouse is running away, squeaking. I would be laith to rin and chase thee, wee murdering pattle. Oh, I don't want to run after you with my spade and murder you. I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal. So there he's writing in a more English register to say, look, you know, we're both creatures of nature. I shouldn't have done this to you. Thy wee bit hoosie, too, in ruin, its silly walls the winds are strewing, and naething now to build a new one, o' foggage green, and bleak December winds ensuing, baith snell and keen. So it's December's about to come out, up. What protection does the poor mouse have now from the winter? Thou saw the fields laid bare and waste, and weary winter coming fast, and cosy here beneath the blast, thou thought to dwell, till crash, the cruel coulter passed out through thy cell, the cruel coulter being the plough blade. That wee bit heap o' leaves and stibble has cost thee mony a weary nibble. Now thou's turned out for all thy trouble, out of house or hold, to thaw the winter's sleety dribble and cranruach cauld. And then he philosophizes, but mousie, thou art no thy lane. You're not on your own. In proving foresight may be vain. Here comes Steinbeck. The best laid schemes o' mice and men gang aft agley, meaning often go wrong, and leave us not but grief and pain for promised joy. Still thou art blessed, compared wi' me. The present only touches thee. But och, I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward, though I canna see, I guess and fear.
Oh, it's so beautiful when you read it.
The difference between the English and the Scots, to me, is when he's speaking in Scots, it's more specific as opposed to the more abstract that you seem to get in the English poems. He really seems to be able to get literally right down to earth when he's talking in his dialect.
Right. He has a real vivid sense of the particular, vivid observation, tremendous sympathy for even the smallest of creatures, this little mouse.
But couldn't you do the same by just saying mouse and house instead of mouse? How did you say it? Mousy and housey? Only you said it better.
Yes.
Well, in other words, the concrete imagery is what seems to make that stand out, whether it's in Scottish or English. The Scottish simply gives it this very quaint, musical feeling.
I think so. And also the Scottish vernacular is very alliterative, right? So you get the alliterative power of the Cranruach called. So
he said, what was it you just said?
The Cranruach called means just hoarfrost.
Okay.
Right, but Cranruach called really has the feel of it in your bones.
It does.
It?
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Again, more down to earth. Mm-hmm. Well, another poem where he is taking up a subject that I can't quite imagine anyone else having done before is To a Louse, which also contains one of his most famous lines.
This again goes back to a particular occasion. We have to imagine Burns is sitting in church on Sunday, and in front of him is a woman who's wearing a bonnet in the latest French fashion, he tells us. It's like a huge balloon bonnet. So clearly she's a lady of high pretensions. But my goodness, there's a louse crawling up that bonnet, which means she has lice in her hair. And so Burns uses this particular occasion of watching this louse creeping up the woman's bonnet. Clearly he's not listening to the sermon.
No.
taking a humorous look here at human pretensions.
And political, too, isn't it? A little bit if even the pretentious, well-dressed, with French fashion women have lice, it's not just something for peasants.
Exactly. Yes, that's a good point. And of course, as I said earlier, Burns was very influenced by the democratic ideals coming out of the American Revolution and the French Revolution. And he strongly believed in social equality. Really didn't have much patience for English or Scottish lords strutting around in their finery. He is, again, directly addressing not a mouse, but a louse in this occasion. Ha! Where are you going, you crowling fairly? Your impudence protects you sairly. I canna say, but you strunt rarely our gauze and lace. Though faith, I fear you dine but sparely on sic a place. Rather grim little detail, like there's not much to eat if you're on the bonnet. And then here, I think, is where he has this invective against the louse, where this Scottish vernacular really is effective. Ye ugly, creeping, blasted warner, detested, shunned by saint and sinner, how dare ye set your foot upon her? Say, fine a lady. Gae somewhere else and seek your dinner on some poor body. It's a social comment there. Mm. Now hold ye there. You're out of sight. Below the fatrals. Faderals, which is sort of decoration. Snug and tight. Nay, faith ye yet, you'll no be right till you've got on it. The very topmost towering height. Oh, Mrs. Bonnet. Oh, well, it's coming out, climbing to the very top. I would not be surprised to spy on an old wife's flannel toy, or perhaps some bit duddy boy on his wily coat. But Mrs. Fine Lenardi, fie, how dare you do it? And then he addresses the woman directly and actually uses her first name, so brings her down a peg. Oh, Jenny, dinna toss your head and set your beauties all abreed. Ye little ken what cursed speed the blastie's making. They winks and finger ends I dread are notice taken. And then here's the moral. Oh, would some power the gifty gie us to see ourselves as others see us. It would from mony a blunder free us and foolish notion, what airs and dress and gait would leave us an even devotion. At least he didn't give her second name, but I'm sure people in the local community would certainly know who Jenny was. But yeah, he loves to use local characters to illustrate common human failings and pretensions.
Well, let's ratchet things up a notch and look not just at the failings of an individual, but maybe to some extent of the social context of that individual in Tam O'Shanter when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
The friendly, knowledgeable, and helpful people in our Audience Services Center are available to answer your program questions and take your comments. Call them at 1-800-747-7444.
When Chapman Billies leave the street and druthy neighbours meet, as market days are wearing late and folk begin to tack the gate, while we sit boozing at the nappy ale and getting foo and unco happy, we think not on the long Scots miles, the mosses, waters, slaps and stiles that lie between us and our hame, where sits our sulky, sullen dame, gathering her brows like gathering storm, nursing her wrath to keep it warm. This truth found honest Tam O'Shanter, as he free air e night did canter. All there whom ne'er a town surpasses for honest men and bonny lasses. O Tam, had thou but been sae wise as ta'en thy ain wife Kate's advice, she told thou well thou was a skellum, a blethering, blustering, drunken blellum.
We'll find out exactly what a blellum might be in a moment. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Carol Newlands. And we're looking at the poetry of Robert Burns, whose birthday we celebrate each year, many of us, on January 25th, although Tam O'Shanter is also quite suitable, as it turns out, for Halloween. There is so much packed into that great bumpy story that I'm not sure where to begin, but it's certainly advice to those who celebrate too much, isn't it, in any event?
Well, that's not exactly clear. I think you could also say that it's a great celebration of the joys of social conviviality. There's definitely two voices going on in this poem.
The moral does sit there, and we'll get to that maybe in a minute. It does seem sort of tacked on after all this wonderful merriment, but Tam O'Shanter is going to go through, literally going to go through hell to get home.
That's true. We already see the two voices, though, right in that opening section that I read, where we have this sort of moralizing voice. Okay, you know, we need to think about the future. We can't just live for the moment, this truth Tam O'Shanter found. But then we have the author's points aside saying, yes, he's from Ayr, and, oh, that's the best place for bonnie lassies.
But he should have taken his wife's advice. But that's right. Well, can you give us a little help with the language of what you read, going back a bit when it's, we said, bousing at the nappy and getting foo and unco happy?
Yeah, well, we say boozing, right? Mm-hmm. Drinking hard at the nappy is the word for ale. Getting foo means getting drunk. And unco happy, very, very happy.
Uncommonly happy.
Uncommonly
happy. All right,
happy.
So what's a blellum?
Blellum is someone who just babbles.
That happens.
She doesn't want to listen to his nonsense, I guess.
That happens when you get foo.
So he's got a hard choice. He's got the storm outside to navigate to get home, and he's got the storm waiting at home.
Yes, he's kind of dug himself into a hole, hasn't he? But again, there are difficulties that he hasn't even foreseen in his attempt to get home.
Right. Well, I think Burns does a wonderful job of evoking at the beginning. It's the end of the market day. Tam O'Shanter has been at market and he's sitting having a good time with his friends. And the wind outside is getting higher and stronger and the rain is starting to lash. And he's oblivious to what's going on outside in nature. He's just having a good time with his friends, warm and happy. But the hour awaits when he must go on his horse through the dark.
Is Tam O'Shanter, it's the name of a hat also, the Scottish hat. Does that come from Burns or is it a generic Scottish name?
I'm not sure about this, but I think that Shanter is named after this poem because Burns talks about how when Tam is riding through the wind, he pulls close down his good blue bonnet to keep himself warm. This poem seems to be loosely based on an incident that happened to a friend of Burns who came from a farm known as the Farm of Shanter. So Tam O'Shanter means Tam of the Farm of Shanter.
Well, take us into the storm with Tam and the stormy times.
Into the twilight zone, as it turns out. I mean, this has another dimension to it.
Right. So it's a terrible night. It's a night in which Burns said, you know, the devil probably had business on hand. So the wind is howling, the rain is lashing. Tam has several miles to go through a wood which is known to be haunted and regularly inhabited by witches. There's been murders taking place there, children smothered. And what's more, there is a ruined church in the middle of this wood, the Church of Alloway, or the Kirk of Alloway, which you can actually visit today if you want to go on the Burns tourist trail. It's still there. However, you know, he's got the a good dose of whiskey and ale to keep him warm and happy. He's got a good grey horse called Maggie. He gallops through the woods, crosses the bridge of the River Doon, which is in full flood. And it's important then that the wood is, in a sense, spanned by two bridges, right? He enters the twilight zone, essentially, by going over one bridge, and he's got to get over another bridge to get home and safe. So here he's in this wood, and suddenly he sees a light in the woods. And it's the church. Now, the church is ruined. No one's had services there for a long time. But the church is full of light. And what's more, there's music coming from the church. It's like a double of the place that he just left, of the pub. It's like there's a celebration. There's a party going on. And, well, okay, so he's got, you know, the drunk man's curiosity and courage. And he reins in his horse and decides that he will take a look and see what's going on. I think he wouldn't mind another party. So here's the moralizing. Inspiring bold John Barleycorn, that's the whiskey, what dangers thou can make us scorn. We tippany, we beer, we fear no evil. We usquabae, it's a Gaelic word for whiskey. We'll face the devil. And that exactly is what Tam is going to face. The swatsy reamed in Tammy's noddle. Fair play, he cared na devil's a bottle. But Maggie, that's his horse, stood right sair astonished. She didn't want to go up, till by the heel and hand admonished, she ventured forward to the light. And wow, Tam saw an unco sight, a strange sight. Warlocks and witches in a dance. But hey, here's again a swipe at the pretensions. This was nae cotillion brent new free France, but local Scottish ceilidh dancing. Hornpipes, jigs, strathspeys and reels put life and metal in their heels. A Winnock bunker in the east, there sat old Nick in shape of beast. A towsy tyke, black, grim and large, to give them music was his charge. He's a bagpiper. He screwed the pipes and gart them skirl till roof and rafters all did dirl. So the devil's a talented bagpiper. It's a grim environment. Coffins stood round like open presses that showed the dead in their last dresses. And by some devilish cantrip's light, each in its cold hand held a light. By which heroic Tam was able to note upon the holy table a murderer's bones and gibbet earns, twa spanlang wee unchristened bairns, two babies that hadn't been christened, a thief new-cutted free a rape, wi' his last gasp his gob did gape, five tomahawks wi' blood-red rusted, five scimitars wi' murder-crusted, a garter which a babe had strangled, a knife a father's throated mangled, whom his own son of life bereft, the grey hairs yet stuck to the heft. We mero horrible and awful, which even to name would be unlawful. As Tammy glowered amazed and curious, the mirth and fun grew fast and furious. The piper loud and louder blew, the dancers quick and quicker flew. They reeled, they set, they crossed, they cleekit, till every carlin swat and reekit, and cast her duddies to the work and linket at it in her sark. So
dance.
All the witches threw off their clothes and danced around in their undergarments. The sark is a very short undershirt.
And is Burns writing this like a fairy tale, like a ghost story for a particular audience?
Well, it's a ghost story, but it's also a big spoof on epic, is it not? He calls Tam the heroic Tam, right? He's the Odyssey character who is always wanting one more adventure, who's more audacious for his own good, right?
He gets a little more than he bargains for.
Yes, so we get, you know, epic similes like the I think I read at the beginning, pleasures are like poppies spread. You seize the flower, the bloom is spread. You get the alliteration, you get the encounter with the monstrous, the otherworldly. So it's a big spoof on epic. It's really an epic done in Scots dialect.
And the horse is saying, I'm not going in there.
Yeah. The horse has good sense, but...
And I must have a different edition of that poem because mine refers to also priests and lawyers that are there.
You know, there's many different versions of Burns's poems that have been edited. That sounds very Burns, actually, to take a further swipe at the establishment. Makes him very much like Dante in the Inferno. He was going to put lawyers and priests and popes themselves in hell. Probably when he uses the word priest, he might actually be attacking Catholic priests. You know, he was a Presbyterian.
So if this is a sort of mock epic... How does it end then? Does Tom come out the hero?
He does, but I think actually, and this is typical again of Burns's subversive humor, it's really his good-sensed horse that comes out the hero. Tam is fascinated by these witches dancing around in their underwear, and there happens to be a young witch there, Maggie, so-called. And Tam is fascinated particularly by her. She's not one of these, she's not an old lady like the others, but she's a little bit more plump and winsome, relatively speaking. And he finally loses his reason altogether, so says our narrator, and shouts out, "Well done, Cutty Sark." He's calling her Cutty Sark, which means short shirt. Right? Which, of course, gives the name to the whiskey and the famous sailing ship, Cutty Sark. And if I can just read the ending here, in an instant, all was dark because he's revealed that he's been watching. And scarcely had he Maggie rallied when out the hellish legion sallied. And then we get the epic simile. As bees biz out, we angry fike when plundering herds assail their bike. As open pussy's mortal foes, when pop, she starts before their nose. As eager runs the market crowd, when catch the thief resounds aloud. So Maggie runs, the witches follow. We monie an eldritch screech and hollow. But it's Maggie that saves the day because she manages to get in time to the second bridge over the water. And we all know that witches cannot cross running water. And she gets across the bridge, but she makes one mistake. She shakes her tail in defiance at the witches. And Maggie, being young, is up in front and she pulls the tail and yanks it off. So poor Maggie is left with a stump as a memento of her heroism.
Is there a religious overtone to this poem about the satanic?
If there is a religious overtone, I think that Burns is making fun of the various serious brand of religion that was practiced in his day. There was a serious side, very serious side to Calvinism that was deeply entrenched in his area that took the devil very seriously. And here he's really making fun of the devil and these superstitious beliefs too by making the devil quite a good bagpiper, among other things.
Well, there was a I guess a convention in church at that time and place in which sinners would actually be called up before the church and exposed. And this actually happened, well, first, I guess, to a good friend of Burns's, but then to Burns and one of the women, I think the one who became his wife.
Yes, even this serious brand of Calvinism aside, it was standard practice that for Sundays in church in Scotland in Burns's day, you couldn't play cards, you couldn't drink, you had to go to church at least twice a day. Of course, having an illegitimate child was subject to severe disciplinary proceedings. I mean, the church acted as a kind of law court in the realm of morals. So, yes, Burns and the mother of his illegitimate daughter, probably not the woman who became his wife, but his first illegitimate daughter was by a serving girl of his mother's, and his mother actually brought up this child. He wrote a very beautiful poem to the child, too. They had to go and sit on the whipping stool for the whole day on Sunday. So they would sit on the stool right below the pulpit so everybody could look at them and point fingers of shame at them. He also had a good friend who missed church service one day and actually had his servants bring in some potatoes for the evening meal from the field. And for that, he was excommunicated by the local parish. And so this friend took his appeal to a higher body, the presbytery at Ayr, and was acquitted. So we have a poem about that also called Holy Willie's Prayer.
One of those great self-exposure
yes, dramatic monologues.
About a self-righteous man, right?
Yes, a self-righteous man. Yes, this man was a man called William Fisher, and he belonged to this extreme sect of Calvinism that believed that he was one of the elect. That is, he'd been chosen by God at birth, essentially, to have the fast track to heaven.
Yeah.
So really, it didn't matter what he did in his life, because he was chosen as one of the blessed. And so it was believed that it wasn't good deeds that got you to heaven, but it was just by
being elected
by being predestined. And so he was bested then in this lawsuit that Burns's friend brought against his excommunication. William Fisher was a member of the parish that excommunicated Burns's friend. So Burns has him giving a prayer in which he asks God to bring vengeance on Burns's friend and the lawyer who got him off, because on the grounds that William Fisher himself has the fast track to virtue and to God's ear.
But it's a pretty devastating self-indictment before Holy Willie's prayer.
Right. It's
over.
A real self-indictment of the man's narrow-mindedness, his hypocrisy. But again, it shows Burns's genius in taking an abstract idea like religious bigotry, hypocrisy, and bringing it to life by taking a particular local character that was known to many people around and giving him a voice. So here's Holy Willie speaking to God. Yet I am here, a chosen sample, to show thy grace is great and ample. I'm here, a pillar of the temple, strong as a rock, a guide, a ruler, and example to all thy flock. Very high opinion of himself. But yet, O Lord, confess I must, at times I'm fashed, bothered with fleshly lust, and sometimes too in worldly trust vile self gets in. But thou remembers we are dust defiled with sin. O Lord, yestreen thou kens me, Meg. Oh, thy pardon I sincerely beg. Oh, may it ne'er be a living plague to my dishonour, and I'll never lift a lawless leg again upon her. Besides a further mona wow, wee Lizzie's last three times I trow. But, Lord, that Friday I was foo, I was drunk when I came near her, or else, thou kens, thy servant true, would never steer her.
They must have loved that out in the fields and farms and villages of Scotland, of Burns'
right,
time.
And he must have been furious when he read this. And he ends by showing his true colours by calling down a curse upon Burns's friend and the lawyer who got him off. It really shows his entire lack of Christian charity, human fellowship, all the values that Burns believed in. Lord, in thy day of vengeance, try him. Lord, visit him who did employ him, and pass not in thy mercy by them, nor hear their prayer. But for thy people's sake, destroy them, and dinna spare. And then the self-serving end. But Lord, remember me and mine, wee mercies temporal and divine, that I for grace and gear may shine, excelled by none, and all thy glory shall be thine. Amen, amen.
So not too Holy Willie there.
No.
Burns is known not only for Auld Lang Syne, but for hundreds of other songs. We're going to listen to some of the songs of Robert Burns' poetry in a moment when we continue with University of the Air.
Wisconsin Public Radio is online at WPR.org. It's a way to stay in touch. You'll find program information, news features, archived programs, and much more. Visit us anytime at WPR.org.
Until I'm complete master of a tune in my own singing, such as it is, I never compose for it. My way is. I consider the poetic sentiment correspondent to my idea of the musical expression, then choose my theme. Begin one stanza. When that is composed, which is generally the most difficult part of the business, I walk out, sit down, now and then, look out for objects in nature around me that are in unison or harmony with the cogitations of my fancy and workings of my bosom, humming every now and then the air with the verses I have framed. When I feel my muse beginning to jade, I retire to the solitary fireside of my study and there commit my effusions to paper, swinging at intervals on the hind legs of my elbow chair by way of calling forth my own critical strictures as my pen goes. Seriously, this at home is almost invariably my way. What damned egotism.
Robert Burns in a letter to his publisher in 1793. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Carol Newlands, and we're talking about the 18th century Scottish poet Robert Burns. He's known for writing beautiful songs that, of course, are so easily set to music, and it's obvious he went around humming while he was writing the lyrics. Is he known to have been a musician himself? I mean, was the humming good, or do we not know?
I think we don't know, but we know also that he was incredibly important as a song collector. So he rescued a lot of songs from oblivion and their tunes. And so he must have had a good musical ear, I think, to be able to compose the lyrics to the tunes like that. And it seems as if he was hearing the music all the time in his head as he was composing these lyrics. So the music and the words went together intimately.
Do you have a favorite setting?
I'm very fond of the arrangements that Jean Redpath did of Burns's songs. And I think the arrangement for Mary Morrison is lovely, if we could listen to that.
O Mary, at thy window be, it is the wish, the triste door, those smiles and glances let me see, that make the miser's treasure poor. How blithely would I buy the stour, a weary slave, resumed his son, could I the rich reward secure, the lovely Mary Morrison. Yes, string went he, the trembling string, the dance gate through.
Mary Morrison certainly shows the gentle, you might even say, sentimental side of Robert Burns, much like a maybe even more universally known song, one of the ones that he wrote in English, which was Flow Gently, Sweet Afton. But he also had what might be called Scottish anthems that are these kind of short, bold, lyrical songs.
Right. I think one of the most famous, perhaps, is the one that he wrote celebrating Robert Bruce's march to the Battle of Bannockburn, which is probably familiar to listeners who have seen the film Braveheart. Scots Wehe We Wallace Bled, which is a great sort of rousing battle song. It also has a political context that was more recent. Burns was celebrating the victory of Bannockburn over the English in 1314. But also he was trying to arouse a sense of national defiance and pride at a time when a young Glasgow lawyer had been hauled off to London in chains for trying to initiate some parliamentary reform. I'll read a couple of stanzas. Scots Wehe, we Wallace bled, Scots whom Bruce has often led, welcome to your gory bed, or to victory. Now's the day and now's the hour, see the front o' battle lower, see approach proud Edward's power, chains and slavery. Edward was the king who was opposing Bruce at the time, so so two choices for the Scots, chains and slavery or victory.
And were the English reading a poem like that at the time? I would gather that they would not be too happy.
Well, luckily, I think one of the strengths of Burns, is it not, is the sheer variety of his verse. And, I mean, so he's celebrating an event, theoretically, that had happened 400 years before, right? Even although he had contemporary events in mind.
In a broader vein, and along the same tone, though, that man's a man for all that is another one of those that has that stirring refrain.
Yes, and Burns was very influenced by Tom Paine's book, The Rights of Man, which was published in 1791 to 1792. And in fact, Burns possessed a copy of this, which was actually treason under British law at the time. Mm. So the thoughts of a man's a man for all that very much are linked to the ideas in Paine's pamphlet that was issued in two parts. It's a really a wonderful, I think, great hymn to the common man. And all that and all that means all the external nonsense and pretensions and social hierarchies and wealth that gets in the way of recognising true wealth. What though on homely fare we dine, we're hodden green and all that? Give fools their silks and knaves their wine. A man's a man for all that. For all that and all that, their tinsel show and all that. The honest man, though e'er say poor, is king o' men for all that. Ye see yon birkie, cod a lord, a birkie's a fellow, wha struts and stares and all that. Though hundreds worship at his word, he's but a coof, a fool for all that. For all that and all that, his ribbon star and all that, the man of independent mind, he looks and laughs at all that. Then let us pray that come it may, as come it will for all that, that sense and worth o'er all the earth may bear the gree, the reward, and all that, for all that and all that, it's coming yet for all that, that man to man the world o'er shall brothers be for all that.
Yeah.
His final poem is a kind of a platonic love poem.
And how tragic that he died in his 30s.
Yes, and one of the myths about Burns is that he died of alcoholism. In fact, he died most likely from having to do heavy work on the farm from a little boy. He died of rheumatic heart failure. And he was nursed in his final illness by a serving girl called Jessie Lewis, a sister of one of his fellow excisemen. He had become an exciseman in his latter years, farm work being too hard on him. And he dedicated this last love poem to her as she was nursing him. Oh, wert thou in the cold blast on yonder lea, my plaidy to the angry airt, I'd shelter thee, or did misfortune's bitter storms around thee blow, thy build should be my bosom to share it all, to share it all. Oh, were I in the wildest waste, so black and bare, the desert were a paradise, if thou wert there, if thou wert there. Or were I monarch of the globe, with thee to reign, the brightest jewel in my crown would be my queen, would be my queen.
We're just a few days away from January 25th, the birthday of Robert Burns, and there are Burns Days around the world. Can you say something about what is done at those Burns Days?
Do they eat haggis?
They eat haggis, and there's a very important ceremony according to which you serve and eat haggis, so you must follow the ritual. So the haggis, which is, do I need to explain? Mm-hmm. Well, essentially, it's a, I call it a Scottish sausage, right? Except it's round-shaped. It's a bit like what you might call an English pudding. And traditional haggis will use the sheep's stomach as the what you might otherwise use as the plastic to contain the chopped-up innards of an animal. But the key ingredient has to be, of course, for Scots is oatmeal. So there must be a plentiful amount of oatmeal to bind the innards and black pepper together. So this is brought in and then Burns's poem, Ode to Haggis, is recited over the haggis and then it is pierced with what's called the skean dhu, which is a short dagger that a Scotsman will wear tucked into the sock of his kilt. And then there will be two toasts proposed over the haggis in Burns's honour to the lassies, and then the reply of the lassies. And then as you're eating the haggis, there will be a speech to the immortal memory of Robert Burns. And plentiful whiskey also has to be consumed to help the haggis go down.
I was going to say some of it maybe even before the haggis to also get you into
before.
The right frame of mind.
Okay, so this is a great defense of Scottish cuisine. So, address to the haggis. Fair for your honest sonsy face, friendly face. And I think this is a great tribute. Great chieftain, oh, the pudding race, is the haggis. Above them all, you tack your place, painch triper therm. Weel are you worthy o' grace, as lang's my arm. His knife see rustic labour dight and cut you up wi' ready slight, trenching your gushing entrails bright like ony ditch. And then, oh, what a glorious sight, warm reekin' rich.
Carol Newlands, thank you for being our guest on University of the Air. What a delightful celebration of Robert Burns.
Next time, bring the haggis.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
This is Alex Beaton with some familiar lyrics by Robert Burns.
Now's the day and now's the hour. See the front of battle hour. See approach proud Edward's power. Chains and slavery. War will be a traitor name. Walk and fell a coward's grave. Or say peace as be a slave. Let him turn and flee. Or for Scotland's king and law, freedom's sword will strongly draw. Free man stand or free man fall, let him follow me. By oppression's woes and pains, by our sons in servile chains, we will drain her dearest veins, but they shall be free. Proud a sorper low, tyrants fall in every foe, liberty's in every blow. Let us do our
travel with us next Sunday afternoon at 4 as we go to California, the year 1849. Who really was involved in that great California gold rush and who got rich and who didn't? Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.